You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome back to the Backcountry Rookies Podcast. I'm your host, Chad Riker, and I'm very happy to have this show today. Here in just a few minutes, we got Robbie Denning coming on. Robbie's going to be talking about some mule deer stuff. But before we get to that, I wanted to make sure and mention Elk 101's University of Elk Hunting is the primary sponsor for this show. And if you use the code ROOKIES when you're at checkout for the University of Elk Hunting, you get 20% off. So you save $20 right off the top. That doesn't include the additional savings that you get once you're a member. You also get some other savings from other companies that are partnered up with University of Elk Hunting. Once you're in there, you get other discounts. So enjoy that. And then I also wanted to bring to your attention that the University of Elk Hunting also has a mobile app that you can use. So you can reference all of the material that's encompassed in the University of Elk Hunting anytime, anywhere. You don't need cellular connection. You don't need internet connection. And you can still reference that material. So if you put yourself in a situation where you have some questions and you're in the backcountry, you're chasing down that big bull of your lifetime, you can reference that material right there on your cell phone. Kind of a big deal. I wanted to mention really quick also that I have a giveaway going on right now, and it's only going to last for a few more days, and that's with Team Bad Decision. We had them on here recently on a podcast, a few podcasts ago, and Travis and Scott came on and talked about their book that they're releasing, Team Bad Decision, which is titled An Evolutionary Tale in Backcountry Hunting. So pretty cool. They're doing a giveaway. Travis is going to give away a paperback book or an ebook, whichever one the winner gets. There's only a few more days left, though, so jump over on the Instagram page at Backcountry Rookies, and you'll see a post that's got the cover of the book, and it says Team Bad Decision. It's got the title and stuff on it. You'll see it. All you got to do is jump in there. You got to follow Backcountry Rookies. You got to follow Team Bad Decision. And then like the post and tag three of your buddies. So pretty cool. And then I also wanted to mention we had an Onyx hunt map giveaway here recently. And the winner of that was Justin Bray. So congratulations to Justin. Enjoy it, man. He texted me right after and he said he's been using Onyx and he loves Onyx to hunt where he's at in Kentucky. But he's getting ready to do a backcountry hunt in Colorado, and he's pretty pumped up because now he'll have another state, right? So he has the opportunity for another state. Congratulations to Justin. I appreciate everybody that entered into that. We had, I think that when it was all said and done, I did the random number generator, and I had, I want to say it was about 147 entries. So I appreciate all of the involvement with that. Also, so we got Team Bad Decision book giveaway going on. And that ends on the 22nd of March. So get entered for that within the next few days. Next month, we're going to have another giveaway going on with Elk 101. And that's giving away one membership to University of Elk Hunting and a call package just like before. So make sure you're watching for that around April 1st. I'll be mentioning it in a couple more podcasts before that releases. And I also wanted to mention, so some of you're going to hear here pretty soon how this Robbie Denning episode came about. And a lot of that information, so what I did was I brought on a guest host to interview Robbie Denning, and you'll get that. But that idea came from the Backcountry Rookies Nation Facebook group page. So if you're not a member of the Backcountry Rookies Nation, you might want to jump over there and check it out, because I ask a lot of questions over there about upcoming shows, or I get ideas from upcoming shows from people, and we just have some discussions about topics, and I'll read those discussions. And it might prompt an idea for an upcoming show. So it's something to think about, right? If you want to have input into what happens on the Backcountry Rookies podcast, that's the place to do it. So just an idea. Jump over there and check it out. Backcountry Rookies Nation on Facebook. I think I got all of that information I wanted to cover. I think I got all that out of the way. We're going to jump into this show with Robbie Denning. It's kind of a long one. I wasn't worried about shutting this thing down at an hour. It's a great show. There's so much information covered in it. And it's, as always, it's Robbie Denning at his best, covering really good quality mule deer hunting information. Let's jump into it. Here we go. As I mentioned in the last show, today we've got an interesting show. I mean, this is something different. I don't think anybody else is doing this type of show, but so as you know, the Backcountry Rookies, we cover a lot of hunting information and we try to educate and inspire people to get out and hunt. And through the course of the show up to this point, I had a listener who was listening, and he kept asking me questions about mule deer hunting. And I realized that we really didn't have any mule deer information out there for people that were, maybe it's whitetail hunters that are wanting to come out west and they're wanting to challenge themselves in the mountains and hunt mule deer and not elk. So up to this point, we've been pretty much talking about elk and a little bit of moose and some bear stuff here and there, but we haven't hit mule deer. So I took the opportunity, and Ryan Johnson had reached out. He was the one that kept, you know, kind of hitting me with little questions here and there about mule deer. And I reached out to Ryan, and we talked about some of the questions that he had. So I asked Ryan to put together some show notes in thinking that I would have somebody come on and talk about mule deer. Well, the show notes that he sent me, or the questions rather that he had sent me, were really good, and they were seemed to be really thought out. So I thought, well, what good am I? You know, I've got all these questions. I have a listener that's really, really interested in mule deer. So why not bring Ryan on the show as a co-host and have Ryan do the interview? And Ryan and I talked about it, and he was on board, and it seemed like a great idea. So then we had to find a subject matter expert for mule deer. And I had one name that immediately came to mind, and that was Robbie Denning. So through this show right now, I'm able to put Ryan in touch, and I've got Robbie Denning on the line here too. And Ryan's going to get to ask any question that he wants to regarding mule deer. So with that, long intro, and I'm sorry, but I wanted to introduce the show, and I wanted to try to introduce it properly. With that, I'm going to let Ryan introduce himself a little bit, and then we'll switch over to Robbie, and we'll do some intro with Robbie. Ryan Johnson, if you want to introduce yourself really quick, just give us a little quick elevator speech on who you are and what's going on.
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Ryan Johnson. I am currently living in northern Idaho in the Panhandle region. I'm from northern Minnesota, where I kind of grew up deer hunting, whitetail, you know, like stand hunting and such. But since I moved out west, I've been elk hunting. I've gotten elk the last couple of years, but I have not been able to figure out how to effectively mule deer hunt this area. And yeah, my goal this year is to get out mule deer hunting more and hopefully harvest some sort of mule deer.
Okay, great. Well, hopefully we were able to help you do that today. And with that, hopefully we're able to help with the knowledge that Robbie Denning is able to bring to the show. So I'll transition over. And Robbie, if you could give a quick intro about yourself. There's plenty of Robbie Denning information out there, but I just, if you don't know who Robbie is, then you'll get a quick little intro from him. So Robbie, take it away.
Yeah. Hey, thanks guys. And thanks for having me on. Robbie Denning. I live in Southeast Idaho. I'm pretty much addicted to hunting mule deer and no signs of recovery so far. My dad started taking me when I was about 8 years old, and I hunted throughout my teens, just casually pretty much, but you know, really had the bug by the time I was 20, 21, somewhere in there. And just by the time I was in my mid 20s, I figured out that's pretty much all I wanted to hunt was mule deer. And we'll talk about that more, but kind of had to only hunt mule deer if I wanted to be good at it, you know, with my resources and what I was able to do. So that's, I'm 50 now, so 25 years hunting almost exclusively mule deer, and that's what I like to do.
Yeah, well, you're good at it, that's for sure. Yeah, well, so recently, and this is a point that I wanted to bring up because I think it's really important, and it shows some of the reason why I reached out to Robbie and why I think he's the subject matter expert. So recently, Robbie was invited to the Salt Lake City Hunting Expo, and he put on a seminar, and that whole seminar is just dedicated to hunting big mule deer. Robbie's got a book that he wrote, and we're going to jump in. We're going to talk about the book here shortly, but I wanted to make sure to point people, if you're interested in listening to that Hunting Expo seminar, which is fantastic, Avery Adventures did a whole, they recorded it and they released it as a podcast. So you're able to go over to Avery Adventures and you can listen to that whole seminar. Am I missing anything about the seminar, Robbie, that I need to include on that?
No, it's all there. I think Ryan, who's the co-owner of Rockslide, my business partner, he runs Avery Adventures. They sent down a professional mic. Our assistant editor, Justin Crossley, was there. I mean, they did it right. It's got good sound, even though, you know, it was done in an auditorium style setting, which sometimes they don't come across really well. But no, that one came across. I was really happy with it. So if anybody wants to listen to that, Salt Lake's a long ways from a lot of guys. No way for them to get there. That's where we're sending them.
Yeah, perfect. And I'll link that podcast into the show notes when I do it. Cause I think, like I said, I think it's an outstanding resource. And, Ryan, were you able to listen to that?
I did. Yeah. It was great. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, good. I think I had sent it to you and I just checked and see if you had listened.
Yep. Yeah. I like to be able to tell stories about hunts that I've been on. And kind of tie the techniques in that way. And, you know, you don't get a platform to do that on very often. And that worked really well. So I took people through four of my last buck hunts and just how I brought together, you know, tracking and still hunting and ambush hunting and glassing and all that other stuff. And, you know, where it worked, where it didn't, all that stuff.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you. And then one other thing I definitely wanted to touch on before we get going, and you had mentioned, or we were talking about Ryan and we mentioned Rockslide. So tell me really quick, or tell Ryan and I, or tell all the listeners that what your involvement is with Rockslide and kind of what Rockslide is.
Rockslide is a big online magazine / forum. And so, we have a staff of writers, you know, just like a print magazine, and our main focus is gear and getting people ready for the season, you know, fitness wise. So virtually all our articles are dedicated to that, with you know, a few side articles on, you know, the how to of, you know, calling elk, tracking mule deer, you know, blind hunting for antelope, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's free to join. It's at Rockslide, rokslide.com. Your listeners should go check it out. And it does have a forum. We try to keep the forum clean where anybody can post. Don't have a bunch of blowhards on there that won't let anybody else talk. We try to get rid of those guys. So it's just a good resource for anybody from a brand new hunter all the way to a very experienced hunter. There's some of our members that are really the best of the best out there as far as honing their craft, you know, from Alaska to even around the world. We've got some international hunters on there, and, you know, they're sharing, you know, how they prepare, you know, what they're doing in the off season, you know, what they're looking for during the season. And it's just a good resource for people.
Yep. I agree. Totally agree. I use it a lot. I go in there and read a lot of articles, and then there's great classified. So if you're looking for some used gear that maybe you don't want to buy something brand new, you can jump in the Rockslide classifieds and almost always find something that you're looking for. I think we'll just jump right into the show and get it going. Like I mentioned before, I'm going to kind of take a step back and I'm just going to let Ryan and Robbie talk. So, take it away, guys.
All right. As far as where to start, yeah, I'm used to hunting deer out of stands, and now out in the mountains where there are elk, whitetail and mule deer. I'm just kind of curious what, in like a situation like that, where are you starting as far as like elevation goes? Where are you starting your mule deer hunt?
Well, because, you know, Western terrain is so varied from, you know, mule deer exist from, you know, clear up in the Yukon in Canada all the way down into almost to South America. I can't remember what the dividing line is above that where we run out of them, but it's also different that to talk about elevation can get people focused on the wrong thing. Now, elevation certainly matters, and mule deer, especially bucks, they seem to like to have a vantage point, and they like to be on top of things. So if you take a unit that has got, you know, 10,000 foot ridge lines, and say the valley floor is at 5,000 feet. When I was younger, I would just go up to the 10,000 foot ridge line. But over the years, I've kind of found out that, yeah, there'll be some bucks there if there's deer country there. But if I only go there, I'm just looking at a small portion of the deer country, because there may be a knob down off that ridge, 1,000 feet, you know, the ridge, the spine of the ridge drops down on a, what we call a secondary ridge. And then there'll be a knob down there that, you know, maybe it's only at 8,500 feet or so, and there'll be bucks on that knob. And so if I only think of elevation, I think I'm kind of restricting guys to just the top of the mountain, and that's not the only place they exist. And in fact, in general season units where, you know, there's more than a few tag numbers, and it doesn't seem to matter if it's backcountry, there's a lot of guys that are, you know, not afraid to do what it takes to get in the backcountry. Sometimes that's where all the hunters are concentrated too, is, you know, at the highest elevations. And then that can also be complicated in that sometimes there's no deer country at the highest elevations. And by deer country, I'm talking about something that holds bedding and feed and thermal cover. If it doesn't have that, it doesn't matter what elevation it is. The bucks are not going to be there. And that's why I referred, you know, kind of back when I was younger, because, you know, we didn't have Google Earth. We didn't have any of that stuff. You know, we just had a paper map, and you looked for, you know, the highest place, and that's where you went. And that's still not a bad strategy, but it's, you're limiting yourself if you're only thinking about elevation, is what I'm trying to say. And then by the time you throw in all the different seasons that mule deer hunting occurs, because I know you're in northern Idaho, and so, you know, you've got mule deer season starting in mid-August if you draw a rifle tag in some of those units, and then going clear into December, if you think about it that way, then elevation almost becomes irrelevant, because during those different times you're hunting them, they're going to be at widely different elevations. So, you know, the early August part of that, they typically are in the highest, most open portions of their range. And then by the time you move to December, they're at the lowest, typically, not always. It just, you know, again, it depends. There's some deer that winter very, very high because they can get up on open slopes, and, you know, they might be able to winter at, you know, 2,000 feet above classic winter range. So you kind of see where I'm going with all that. But when I read your question here, I thought, well, I guess I don't think about elevation as much as what I hear it talked about. It's important, but it's just a small piece of the entire puzzle, is how I would put it.
Yeah, totally. It was something I'd been trying to figure out, but I just, without having a whole bunch of time out in the woods, I wasn't able to figure it out.
Well, start high, always start high. And, you know, that's where your glassing points are, your vantage points. You know, I'm not trying to say, you know, just go hunt in the bottom. No, not at all. But wherever you're at, it does, even if it's desert type country, the bucks like the up and down country, and left alone, they're usually going to be higher, even if it's a flat desert floor outside of Sonora, Mexico. I hear that those deer just really try to stay in the flats down there. But, you know, a lot of places they're, even if it's relatively gentle country, they're going to be on the knobs and the little fingers, and, you know, that's where I look for them first. So it is that they typically are at the highest points in any given range, especially early in the season before the rut. And then after the rut, you know, they're headed to wherever the ladies are, and, you know, those does and fawns are typically in gentler terrain.
Mm-hmm. Does when you have your higher peaks without that don't have a whole lot of timber coverage, but it's really thick down below, do you find that the deer prefer one area versus the other, like at certain times of the year as well, or how
You go, well, they're just like you and me. We don't ever get very far from our refrigerator. And so they're going to be where their feed is. And so I just got a magazine yesterday, Epic Outdoors, Jason Carter's magazine. And on the front of the magazine, if you look at it, and if you're not a subscriber, just go to their site. It's probably up on their site for their current issue. Look at that picture of that goat and where that guy killed it. And look at those peaks behind him. And I used to think mule deer lived on those peaks. But if you look at them, yeah, they're high. They got the, you know, they're probably the highest peaks in that unit. You know, they, if you're sitting at home on Google Earth looking at those mountains, you're going to think, man, all I got to do is get up on those mountains. I'm going to kill myself a big mule deer. There are no deer on those mountains. There's not enough feed. They're too rocky. And so you've got to go where their feed is. And you know, they eat every day, even during the rut. You know, they're eating. And, you know, they can eat a wide variety of foods. It's really kind of hard to narrow that down as well. And they can't live where there's no feed. That's what I'm trying to get at here. And that's why elevation in a way is kind of limiting. Even Western Wyoming, which is east of me here, it's got some of the best deer country in the world. There's still a lot of those peaks that don't have any deer on them because they're just too rocky. Now, you know, you may move down the peak, you know, 800 feet in elevation and get into a green band of herbs and forbs and, you know, bedding cover and stuff like that. And they'll be right there. But I guess what I'm trying to get across is just elevation is just one little piece of the puzzle. But as soon as you lay eyeballs on that country off of Google Earth, you're going to know, gosh, there's just not enough feed there. Deer like rocky country. Don't get me wrong, but it's got to have feed in the country. They don't typically live in goat country. If they live in goat country, there's still feed adjacent to it, you know, within often just a few hundred yards, you know, especially in the early season. These deer are not walking 3 miles to go to breakfast. They're not like that. You know, they're usually living relatively close to where their food is. And so I guess I think about food sources much more than I think about elevation. And what I would tell you is, you know, you mentioned something a minute ago about, and I don't remember quite how you said it, but you said, you know, how do I find these places without spending a bunch of time? You want to think differently. Like, I need to spend time finding these places because anybody can get on Google Earth. Anybody can get on Rock Slide. And that's why a lot of hunters end up concentrated in the same places and units. I can go to heavily hunted units, and I can usually still find country that people aren't hunting because it's not the classic high elevation, you know, type stuff, you know, because that's where everybody goes. I mean, everybody's e-scouting, and there's nothing wrong with it, but it's somewhat limits you, you know, but getting out there, Ryan, and, you know, if I lived in northern Idaho, I know a lot of those mule deer do live on those bigger mountains, especially prior to the rut, you know, so to say up to October 15th, you know, that's where you want to be. But I would be talking to a biologist and a game warden, and I would be saying, okay, so let's just say I'm going to hunt unit 2 for mule deer. Where in the unit are your mule deer typically found? Now, if it's a brand new biologist, you know, he just graduated last year, you know, he's just repeating the stuff to you that he heard from the guy in fisheries, but it's still helpful. Really is. It gives you a place to start. And you know, and the game wardens are even better because a lot of times they're like, oh, the only road we check deer on really is, you know, such and such road. And, you know, so whatever country it's going to is, you know, probably the bulk of our mule deer population. That's how I do it. You know, e-scouting to me is, it's okay. I want to do it. It gives me a feel for the country. It gives me a familiarity of what I'm getting into. It gives me a little bit of confidence. But no, man, I want to see tracks. I want to talk to people that have been there. And, you know, there's especially where you're at, Ryan, it's not the mule deer mecca. And there's those deer, I mean, mule deer always live in pockets. You know, there'll be deer here, and then for 3 miles there's no deer. But I think that's even exaggerated up where you live. And there's probably entire mountains up there that don't have deer on them. You know, they don't have the right aspect and they don't have the feed or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's very, very thick country up there, as you know, but you know, there's, the people are still killing mule deer. I mean, they're killing big ones. You know, one of the best deer killed in Idaho in 2017 came out of that country up there. And, you know, it does have them if, you know, if big mule deer tickle your fancy, but I find even if you're just happy with any deer, if you're applying the techniques that work for big mule deer, it just makes the other bucks that much easier.
I was able to glass up some mule deer last year and I was tracking some, but figuring out where the limits are of where, you know, the mule deer live, I was not sure I was in the right spot. But
you were in the right spot. You saw deer. You just nailed it down right there. And so what I would do this year is that would be the first place I'd go. And you know, I'd be thinking about the dates that I saw them. Okay, it was November, so yeah, they may have moved a long ways to come in there, but maybe not. And you know, and I would start that in August, you know, or July. I mean, I would be up there in July looking around. Is there deer sign here? Is this just does and fawns and the bucks come in here? Or this is where the bucks live. And I scouted Northwest Montana, which is just over the border from you, and you know, very similar country. And I find, you know, that those bucks are just like the bucks down here. They're in the rough and the nasty until the rut comes, and then they're headed for the does, and that might only be a half a mile away. I mean, it might be three mountains away, but you know, right there, you've got the recon that you need, at least to start with. And I would, you know, definitely be looking there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So as you start your mule deer season and the season goes on, when the rut comes, it sounds like the bucks are, you know, they're obviously going to go to where the does are. What's like the time frame for that? Is there kind of a time frame you've been able to figure out when that starts to happen?
Yeah, and the first thing that you've got to convince yourself of is you've got to believe that there actually is a rut. Now, why do I say that? Because I can go to any place in November where the deer are rutting, and I can usually find guys that are just convinced there's no rut. The deer are not rutting this year. The wolves ate them. The coyotes ate them. They've gone celibate. I mean, I've heard it all. And the reason they say that is because they're like, you know, I've been hunting for 3 freaking days. I've walked 20 miles a day. And I have not seen a big buck yet. All these does just have little bucks around them. And there's no rut. So as soon as you start thinking that way, your hunting will reflect it, you know, because you're just convinced it's not happening, you know. And I was up in Montana about 8-9 years ago and hunting in country very similar to yours. And you know, we were seeing bucks rutting. I could tell by the tracks on the ground. You know, I killed a 6-year-old buck. Yet we were running into guys just like, oh no, we just saw some does up the canyon there, no buck around them. No rut this year. They're taking a year off. And it's like, well, I can tell how hard you're going to hunt if you actually believe that. And so where I'm going with all this, I don't go out in the woods and go, okay, I see all this rut activity now. The rut has started. No, I just look at the calendar. And once Halloween rolls around, in the northern mule deer climates from basically southern Colorado north, they are rutting. They have to be. They only have a certain amount of time to rut because the rut is set by when the fawns are going to have the best chance of surviving. And in the northern climates, the best chance for a fawn to survive is going to be if they're born roughly the first couple of weeks of June. And there are exceptions to that. I mean, the whole world's on a bell curve. There's going to be some deer born earlier than that. There's going to be some deer later. But, you know, God knew what he was doing when he set this planet on the axis instead of spinning, that if for these deer to survive and for there to be, you know, a mule deer species into the future, these fawns got to hit that ground that first couple of weeks of June so that they have enough time to gain the necessary weight to enter winter, which is, you know, most mule deer country, that's going to be coming, you know, mid-October or later, and it ain't going to let up until, you know, April. They've got to be heavy enough and big enough that they have a good chance of surviving that winter. And that's been well documented across, you know, various states. And, you know, biologists go out and they weigh the fawns and, you know, they track them. And, you know, the ones that are lighter have a lower survival rate. And the ones that are heavier just typically do better. And so for that to happen, that whatever the gestation period is for mule deer, I don't have it memorized, the number of days, you know, 200 or something like that. But it's basically right around the 10th to the 20th of November, mule deer rut is going to peak. And, you know, it's a little bit weather dependent, you know, as far as, you know, if it's cold and snowy, it just seems to intensify the rut. But it's not like they take the rut off if it's warm and dry. That doesn't happen. And I hear people say that. I really do. That's why I hit on it so hard. I'm like, no, guys, this is sex. They have a sex drive just like we do. And it's at that time of year that they're going to be able to get the most does pregnant and have those babies born. And so that's why I go back to the calendar that, man, I know after Halloween, this is when it's happening. And then when I go out in the forest, you know, it's almost every time for 25 years, it's just been reconfirmed to me. I look at the tracks on the ground. I'm like, okay, that buck is walking in a straight line for a long ways. 2 weeks ago, he wasn't doing that. I would see his tracks and he would feed below this little bush right here. And then he would walk over and he'd feed over that bush. And then he would lay down. I would see his bed and then he would get back up. And I could see that he laid in that bed for a couple hours, but the snow was melted. And now he's just up browsing again. He's not moving very far. Where, man, I get on a set of buck tracks the end of October later, they wear me out. They are moving, and that's because of the rut. They are starting to look for does. And so I want my hunting to mimic that. And so once Halloween rolls around, I'm really paying attention to the does. I go from hunting bucks to hunting does after Halloween. And yeah, every day is different. And this is where guys will argue with me. They're like, man, I was up there on the 10th of November. I saw a frickin' 30 incher out feeding on a hillside with a little 3-point. They haven't even started the rut yet. Oh, you don't know what that deer was doing that night before. He might have bred all night long and he's just out in the morning trying to recover, and that little 2-point wandered up next to him and is feeding by him. And so now in your mind you think it's August. It's not. They're rutting. They have to be. And so that's why I'm paying so close attention to what those does are. And I've hunted a lot in November. You know, most of my hunting's occurred in October because that's when the seasons are. But I've still had a lot of chances to hunt in November. And I've not seen that rule violated yet. You know, I mean, yeah, I've seen bucks alone. You know, I've seen all that stuff in November. But they're still heavily influenced by the does and the rut. And you know, throw into that the migration towards winter range. That, you know, that's what I'm looking at. But if I had to break it down in the northern, you know, mule deer country, like I said, from basically almost southern Colorado north, the 1st to the 10th is the rut is beginning. You know, that's when I see bucks getting out of their summer patterns. You know, they really started getting out of them in late October. But, you know, the 1st through the 10th, they're starting to cruise does. They may not be right with the does at all hours of the day, but at the fringes of light, you know, early morning, the last few minutes of evening, I am always around those does because that's when those bucks show up. It seems like once you hit about the 10th, though, they're hardcore. I will see bucks at all hours of the day, not every day, not every doe herd, but all hours of the day, I will see bucks chasing and courting does. And, you know, and consequently, that's the time, about the only time of year I really hunt all day is, you know, as the rut is starting, because you can get bucks up at any time of the day. And then really through the 11th through the 20th it seems to be that's when it's peaking. You know, just that's when they're in a frenzy, and, you know, they're just constantly chasing does all hours of the day. You know, they're just going for it. But at any given time, though, you could find a herd of does, especially does that are, you know, living close to roads or, you know, being harassed by hunters for whatever reason, maybe they're highly visible. Those big bucks still aren't stupid. You know, they may not be around those does. And that's where I hear guys start saying, well, there's no bucks in this unit or they all been shot out. And it's like, no, just get out and look at more does. They're going to be around them. They've just pulled off into some other place where that they can get it done without everybody, you know, shooting at them and chasing them. And then after the 21st, it does start winding down, but that doesn't mean they're done. I'm still hunting the does, but that's when I'll notice that, wow, there's a herd of does out here this morning. No one's around. There's not even a buck around them. This is weird. You know, he's not in there chasing them. And last week he was all over them. But, you know, then I start glassing and tracking. And sure enough, just one little side canyon over, he's bedded. You know, he's just sitting there. He's all by himself. You know, he's feeding. He seems to be alone. And all of a sudden, 2 o'clock, boom, he's up. Man, he runs right into that herd of does. Because what is happening is the bulk of the does have been bred. And so they're going out of estrus, and those big bucks are just like hound dogs. You know, when during the rut, you know, that's probably the number one thing I see them doing is smelling the ground, because they're looking for does. They're looking for those does that are in heat. And as the does go out of heat, they kind of start, you know, transitioning back to not being so active. But boy, as soon as a hot doe goes in, they will be right on them. And, you know, with whitetails, you know, I'm sure you're aware there's a second estrus if the does don't get bred. And so, you know, I've seen bucks breeding does clear into December, you know, so the does that came into heat in October, in November, you know, November 10th, they didn't get bred. And then here it is, December, you know, 8th or whatever, I think it's a 28-day cycle. There'll be a big buck right back in there with them, you know, and he may not have bred a doe in a week, but as soon as one comes in, you know, he's right there with his hand out. And so that's kind of a long version of how I think about the rut. You know, it's more tied to the calendar for me.
Yeah, that's a ton of great information in there. When the rut starts to dwindle, are the bucks going back to where they were before the rut, or are they like going off into some, you know, even deeper, darker spot where it's hard to, even more difficult to find them?
No, because, and I think, again, this gets into to where they're at in their range. So yeah, if you're in northern Arizona and you know, the strip, those bucks after the rut, they just walk over in the next little canyon and lay down. Those bucks live and rut almost in the same places year round. You know, though, as far as their summer versus their winter patterns are not much different. But, you know, then you move to the Wyoming range here, and those deer have been shown to migrate 150 miles. And so, no, they're not going back to where they were in October. Those deer, they can't. There's 4.5 feet of snow by the time the rut's over. They're 150 miles away down on in the Green River Basin, you know, preparing for winter. And so that's why I'm a little leery on some of these questions, because it makes it sound like there's a formula of, okay, the rut's over now, those deer are just over in that side canyon. It depends on your unit. And that's why you got to invest time in your unit and your area and understand it and talk to a lot of people and hunt it multiple years. And then that stuff all starts to come back together. But let me give you some examples, exact examples of what you just asked of, you know, when the rut is slowing down and starting to end, what are the bucks doing? Well, right around here where I'm at, the bucks have left the highest peaks by the time the rut starts in November, and they're not going to go back to those highest peaks. They cannot winter on them. But the winter range is sometimes just 5 or 6 miles away. You know, they don't have to go a long ways. And so as the rut is winding down, they have followed those does to winter range. But if there's a great big early snow, like in late October, like we had in 91, when we had 400 inches of precipitation, 400% of precipitation in the end of October. You know, we had as much snow at the end of October as we typically have, you know, the beginning of January. Those bucks migrated to that winter range. A lot of them were headed for the winter range then, regardless of the rut, because they had to get out of the snow. They had to go where the groceries were. And so they are in transition to the winter range around here. The rut will interrupt that, and they will make sure they're right with the does all the time. But as the does start going out of estrus, they've been bred, those bucks are just pulling away from them. and going back into rebuilding their bodies, just really like what they were doing in the summer. That's what they're doing in the summer. They're rebuilding their bodies from the rigors of the winter. So they're, you know, they're feeding longer. You know, I don't think they go into some mysterious mode where they're undetectable. I mean, I see a lot of December is a great time to find bucks. You know, they're typically out on the more open slopes. That has to do with the snow levels, because the slopes that aren't open, that are shaded from the sun, you know, they got a couple of feet of snow on them now. There's no food left for them. So they're moving around, you know, to the aspect where they can get, you know, more sunlight, you know, longer days on that slope, higher soil temperatures. So, you know, it's going to hold the feed that they want. And so they've pulled away from the does, but they just may be 100 yards from the does. You know, it's not that they've got this, you know, I've got to get away from the does 5 miles. I mean, there's no formulas is what I'm trying to get at. But typically by the time I get into December, we're back to just doe groups with not very many bucks around them, you know, unless one doe just goes into estrus, you know. So I start looking for bucks outside of, you know, back into the rough country, you know, away from the does. I'm not hunting does so much, although I'm keeping an eye on them. And it's not uncommon to find two or three bucks together out feeding on a big old sunny slope, and they're back to not moving very far. They'll be there every day, you know, where a week before, you know, you see him at 9 o'clock in the morning, and at 11 o'clock, he's moved 3/4 of a mile. You know, they're kind of getting out of that then.
So most of my deer hunting has been whitetail, and I've had quite a bit of success with calling them. Is that, I've never heard of anybody calling in mule deer. Is that because it nobody does, or it doesn't work, or do you ever do that?
No, I don't. And it's probably more to do with that I'm trying to hunt big deer, and so making noise and hunting big deer, like two opposite ends of the spectrum to me. You know, I don't want them to know I'm around. I don't want to give them any indication that I'm around. And so I've toyed with it. I mean, I'm looking at a pair of rattling antlers hanging on in my garage right now, but I haven't had a lot of luck with it. But I'm no expert on it. I mean, I haven't tried. I mean, I maybe 4 or 5 days of my whole life did I actually go out and really try to rattle in a buck. And that was during the rut. And it just was like, well, I just put all these deer on alert right now. They're all looking at me. But having said that, it's really, you're just asking the wrong guy. You need to go look up Fred Eichler, Eichler. He's a guide, and he's a heck of a bow hunter. I believe he's out of Colorado. And there's a book. I don't think he wrote the book, but somebody wrote a book on him, Western Big Game Strategies or something. Just Google it. It's out there. And I don't know if it's in his book or if it's just in the articles I've read, because I haven't read the book, but I've read a bunch of his articles. He's had great luck with rattling and calling. And, you know, it's one of their main techniques, and I probably lending to the fact that he's a, you know, hardcore bow hunter. And, you know, so some of the stuff I've read of him, he said, hey, man, it's very effective, and even on big mule deer. And so, but I'm just not the guy to ask, and I'm probably far enough along in my mule deer career that I've, you know, finding what's working for me. And at this point, I don't have a plan on, you know, going to pick that up and everything, but I would never say that it's not effective.
Okay, man, you covered pretty much all my questions that I had. I guess the last thing I was curious about was what your tactics are for those snowy December hunts. And is there any amount of snow that you can tell that is going to push the deer, or is it a combination of snow and cold that push the deer down, or how does
I find that, you know, now remember, this is all depends on the season. I have seen it snow 18 inches in September on the high peaks, and those bucks don't even move. They just stay there. Where it snows 18 inches the 25th of October, and they are gone. They just leave. So some of it is just dependent on how, I really believe, how close we're getting to winter. Those bucks know that I've only got a certain amount of time to get to winter range. And, you know, they you know, they're pretty smart is what I'm getting at. And so, but this is what I'm getting at. I find the 18 inches of snow or more, that's pretty tough living for deer. That's hard for them to get around in, and they're going to get out of it if they can. And that, in some country, that just means walking 500 yards around the slope and getting onto the southwest facing slide where the side where the snow depths are much lower. And then they just stay there. And that, so, you know, when I say 18 inches of snow, you go to a mountain range and there, you're not going to find a single line on the contour line on the mountain range that holds 18 inches of snow all the way across the mountain, because it goes through all these different aspects. And so some slopes are lower, heck, some slopes are higher because the wind blows it into the slope. And so, you know, it there's only 18 inches of snow has fallen, but there's 3 feet on this slope. And so what I'm looking for is, where can the deer live? You know, where can they get to their feed and, you know, not be forced into deep snows? But once it's about 18 inches, it's pretty hard on them. And I find that they leave, especially the does and the fawns. And so if it's the rut, then I know the bucks have left too. But if it's after the rut, like December, with the question that you're asking me, those bucks will put up with a little bit more snow. Maybe the does are down on the kind of rolling benches that are a little bit lower, you know, they're 500 feet below the bucks. And you know, then the bucks are up on the steeper slopes. And, you know, I'm looking at them in the spotting scope and go, wow, man, they're in snow way over their knees there. You know, and you know, the does are down here, you know, browsing in 3 inches of snow. They'll definitely do that. But there's not much of a formula as far as beyond just I'm looking for deer and I'm looking for their feed and, mm-hmm. and what are they doing? And if it's December, they're probably winding down from the rut and the bucks are going to be pulling away from the does. I'll still find the does because the bucks aren't going to be a long, long ways from them because they're going to be on the winter range by December typically. And so then I'm just looking in the little side canyons and the, you know, the rougher hillsides. And, but all of a sudden, bam, big old buck, December 12th, will walk out and mount a doe. It's like, well, she's in heat for sure. You know, and he left wherever he was at to come over here and breed her. And, you know, as soon as she's bred and out of estrus, he'll be right back, you know, where he was. But probably the biggest thing with December and even into November and late October in the high country when, you know, as far as cold weather hunting goes, this is in my seminar. If you listen to that one on Avery Adventures, that first buck story that I told about that late buck hunt, you probably heard me say it a bunch of times. It's about the logistics of being able to be in the deer country when the deer are moving. And so on that tag that I had, that I took that 187 buck on, the only reason I did any better than those other hunters that were there, because those guys were good hunters. They were actually working harder than I was. They were walking further. They were doing all the He-Man stuff that we read about in the articles and that we envision ourselves doing in the off season. But they weren't, they were not set up to stay in the deer country. They would, you know, leave the truck at 5 o'clock in the morning, hike back to where, you know, I was in my freezing tent. And, you know, they're getting there, you know, decent time, 8, 9 o'clock. But by that time, a lot of the action had occurred. You know, the bucks, even in the heat of the rut, you know, they don't like being out on those big open hillsides. And they, you know, they'll go out and they'll cut a doe out and they'll take her into the cover. And unless you're there glassing when they're doing that, you don't even know they're there. In fact, you know, you're looking at that herd of does at 10 o'clock in the morning, go, well, no rut, no bucks, got to move on. It's like, oh no, man, there's a 185 buck right down there in those trees breeding those does. And so what I'm getting at, it was the logistics. It was all that stuff I talked about of getting my gear back there and then having a backup plan for my dad to bring some horse feed in so that I could continue to stay where the deer were. That was what led to my success. It wasn't anything more than that. Those guys were just not spending a lot of time in the deer country during the prime hours. They were hunting all day, but you know, they were spending a big chunk of their day going back and forth through country that didn't hold any deer, trying to get to country that held deer. and then hoping in that few hours that they were there, the deer actually got up where they could see them. And that got down to logistics, good cold weather gear, you know, scouting enough that I didn't waste any time, you know, going up the wrong canyon or anything like that. So that cold weather hunting to me is all about logistics, because it's flipping cold then. And, you know, you're in survival mode. You know, if you didn't have the right gear and everything, you'd die at that time of year. And so, you know, if you're not set up to live with them and be very close to where they are so that you can check on them multiple times a day, you know, because you're not just going to sit on the glassing knob at, you know, 10 hours when it's 7 degrees. You know, I don't care who you are. You can't, you know, and you can build a big old fire. It doesn't matter. You're not, you know, you're not that effective. And so logistics, having great gear, great cold weather gear, you know, scouting, knowing exactly where to be. And I talked about that in that seminar. I scouted that country in the summer, even though a lot of the mule deer guys tell me, yeah, it doesn't do any good to scout winter range when the deer aren't there. Baloney. Did me a lot of good. I knew exactly where to be. And, you know, even though I was in there in August and there were no deer, I ruled out, hey, that canyon's too thick. That canyon doesn't have a trail in it, but there's some good deer country at the top of it. I need to figure out how to get back up in there. I knew where to camp. I knew where the water was. I knew where all that stuff was. And so that when it got down to the hunt, you know, I'm in the deer country, you know, I'm not just down at the trailhead at, you know, at 3:30 in the morning, which sounds pretty manly, but it's like, you know, you're hiking from 3:30 in the morning to 7 a.m. I mean, you're just wasted 3 hours in the dark. Figure out how to be back where those deer are so that you can spend 3 hours looking for them when they're up and moving. That's the best tips I can give for cold weather hunting right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I did my mule deer hunt last year, I brought my teepee and my stove, and I camped, and yeah, that's what I noticed. There were a lot of people coming like pretty late after mm-hmm. I'd been seeing does moving around. Uh-huh. I was pretty excited to have been up there, and you know, I essentially beat the other, like, people riding four wheelers mm-hmm. and just, you know, just glassing off their four wheeler. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, exactly, dude. And the thing is, you know, if you look at the time that you get up in the morning versus the time they get up, oh, they're getting up way earlier than you, but you're hunting more than they are. You're hunting effectively more than they are, because you're there when the deer are moving. Was that a November hunt?
Yeah, that was like, I think that was right around Thanksgiving, and it was cold, windy, and there was quite a bit of snow. And I picked up on one buck trail, and he like crossed the saddle, and like he had like a beeline for yep. where I don't know where I couldn't pick him up. I tried for a few hours, but yeah, that was cold, late, windy. It was tough.
Well, let's talk about that hunt right there, because, you know, that's really the best, your best information is going to come from your own hunting and scouting. I mean, podcasts are awesome. Articles are awesome. That's why I write them. But it's really your on the ground terminal stuff that's going to add up over the years. And that's why I keep a journal. And I've got, you know, dozens of journals downstairs in my file cabinet that I've written stuff down over the years. And so the main thing I would journal, if you haven't already, is the dates of when you were hunting, where exactly you were at, where you camped, where, what hillsides you glassed, because, you know, that'll become a fog in 4 or 5 years. You'd be like, oh, I can't remember which drainage I went up. I think I was up on the, oh, I can't remember. No, you don't want to forget any of that stuff. And then the dates are important, and the snow levels, because then the next time those conditions come around, you'd be like, you know, on these dates with about this much snow, I remember seeing those does back up that canyon. Now, I don't care if there was no bucks there on the day you were there. That's where hunters go wrong. They're like, well, I went up there and there was some does, but no bucks, so I'm going to move to the next unit. No, there just wasn't any bucks there right when you were there. And you just told me what I needed to know. You found buck tracks, and you said exactly what I said in the beginning of this podcast, is they were lined out. He was headed somewhere. That's why he couldn't track him, because he was moving at, you know, 6, 7, 8 mile an hour. You can't even keep up with him. He had his nose to the ground. If you followed those tracks long enough, you would see where he stopped and smelled the ground. You would see little dribbles of pee, you know, because he's rutting hard. He's, you know, he's leaking. He's marking the territory. Bucks like that are very, very hard to track. But that tells me He found does, confirmed there was a buck in the area. Dude, there's that. That's the best information right there. That's better information than anything I just told you in this entire podcast right there. It's just, it may take you 2, 3, 4 years to bring that all together where the weather's right, the temperature's right, and you're there. You had the right days off work that you actually look back on that hillside where those does were, and there's a 29-inch buck with big cheaters hanging off of him. And what was the difference that year? You just spent enough time right there. And you knew that exact hillside where these does congregate at that time of year. And you just played the game long enough that you finally caught a buck in there. And that guy that's buzzing in there on his four wheeler and glassing for 15 minutes with his $7,000 Swarovski BTX binoculars, he's gone. He wasn't there. And he didn't spend enough time in that unit to ever narrow down where to look. And that's why I see hunters going to and fro all the time. It's like, they're always, the grass is always greener somewhere else. You know, I hunted there. That place is no good. So there's got to be a mule deer mecca out here somewhere, and I just haven't found it. No, you just walked right through the mule deer mecca. It's just that we're moving too fast. We're covering too much country. And that's why that, you know, I wanted to ask about that hunt because, man, everything you just told me, man, I'm getting fired up just thinking about that. And if I knew that spot right there, I'd be checking on that spot every year until I could just rule it out that, you know what? I've been here so many times when there's does here, and for whatever reason, there's never any big bucks, because there are places like that. There certainly are. But more often than not, if it's a secure place, there's not a lot of people coming in and out. Those deer aren't getting bothered. You know, it's not easily glassable. In fact, I have to pussyfoot in there. There's only one place I can see that country, and it's from, you know, 800 yards across the canyon, and I can kind of watch that country. Oh, man, that's a big buck recipe right there during the rut. Eventually, if there's big bucks around, they're going to show up on that hillside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a sketchy hike over there. Yeah, everything was snow covered. I didn't know what I was walking on, but mm-hmm. it was like a boulder field walking this, not like a razorback ridge, but it was pretty sketchy. And but yeah, there was nobody back there, you know, and dude, that's where I found the deer.
That's a prime thing you want to write down. And you may have to visit that 2, 3, 4 years, you know, and a lot of times it just takes a couple of days. You know, that could be one of those spots where, hey, this weekend I'm checking that spot, you know, and as that's why a journal is important. And as you start writing that stuff down, and it goes back to what I said earlier, that you got to spend the time. You can listen to a million podcasts and you still won't get this stuff. If you spend that time over a couple of years, that's the recipe for success. That's the guys I know that killed good bucks year after year after year. That's what they have. They have this library in their mind of, okay, this place is good at this time. This place I've seen bucks at this time, whatever. And then they're just, it's like a trapper with a trap line. They're just checking their trap line. They're just making the rounds. And yeah, on any given day, that spot will scare 20 guys away because I didn't see the deer, no rut, you know, all that stuff I was talking about. But that guy, he knows, no, these bucks come in here. There's big bucks around here. I just got to catch one out of the cover.
Okay. Well, yeah, man, I've been planning a trip up there, but won't stop snowing. And I want to get back up there and check it out and get a better game plan for this year and spend some more time up there.
Yeah. And you may go in there now and there's no deer at all. If there was enough snow, there's no deer at all. Not a big deal. At least you know that. You could measure the snow depths. You could say, okay, when there's this much snow, there's no deer, you know, and then, you know, maybe you check in the spring. You know, David Long wrote about this in his first mule deer book. Everybody should go read that, about reverse migrations. You can scout migrations in the spring as the deer are traveling back to summer range. You can check those migrations in the spring and kind of get an idea of, you know, where the deer move through. It's not as much related to snow depth then, although it can be. And, you know, it's just one more piece in the puzzle for you. And, you know, nothing wrong with checking that out even this time of year in the off season. But, you know, the information that you gathered last year is going to make the most sense come this fall in roughly the same conditions at roughly the same time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, you covered pretty much all my questions and then some. Chad, you had a couple of questions too, I think.
I do. First off, that was awesome. Thanks, guys, because it was a lot of fun just to sit back and listen to that conversation. So, tons of good stuff there. I wanted to go way back to the beginning when you started talking about elevation. And Robbie, you had mentioned hunting that 5,000 to 10,000 range and how elevation, you don't think it plays a big factor, but it's mostly feed and cover. What does that look like when I'm Google Earthing or I'm on my Onyx maps? What kind of cover and feed are we looking for? Or even more importantly, like when Ryan's out and he's boots on the ground and he's scouting, what kind of feed is he looking for and what's that cover look like for him at that point?
Okay, well, I said in my book that I don't know the names of the plants. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, well, what plant? And then they're surprised. I don't know. I kind of know what they look like because I walk in the forest and I look at the ground and I look at where the deer tracks are and what they're feeding on. And I look at the clipped browse and I know a few of them, you know, around here. It's antelope, bitterbrush and, you know, a little bit of sage depending on the time of the year. And, you know, there's numerous forbs that they eat on. Around here, they'll eat on snowberry bush, serviceberry. But I don't really need to know what the names are because number one, the deer don't know what the names are. Okay. So they're just out there eating it. They just know what it looks like, smells like, and where it grows. And so they go to it. So that's really all I have to do. I don't have to be a botanist to be a great mule deer hunter. Not that it would hurt, but, it kind of gets to the elevation thing that we were talking about. I don't want to say elevation is not important, but it's not the deciding factor of where I'm going to go. All right. It's kind of takes care of itself once I find the mule deer country and the mule deer country is where the feed is. And so what I'm looking for is if it's, you know, prior to when there's a lot of snow, it's going to be green. Deer don't eat dead stuff. All right. They eat live stuff. Okay. It's going to be green and, you know, they're browsers. And so it's typically brushy type country, or if it's really high country, it'll be the forbs that just, you know, grow straight from the ground. They're not a bush, you know, they're typically in that 6-inch to 2-foot high range and they're green. Look in my book, you'll see pictures of that stuff. I took pictures of that country, but what it has, in order for plants to grow, it has to have sunlight. It has to engage in photosynthesis. It has to convert sunlight to a carbohydrate and, you know, and proteins and all the things that happens through photosynthesis. And then it's stored in the leaves and the branches and, you know, all that other stuff. And that's how deer get their food. And so it has to have sunlight is what I'm getting at. All right. Now I talk to people like, oh, the deer around here, they just live in the timber all the time. No, they can't. There's no feed in the timber. Walk in the timber, look at the ground. It's a virtual desert. They can't eat pine needles. They don't eat pine cones. Okay. I realize that they may be living in very thick country, but they have to be feeding in semi-open, broken country. And so like in Northwest Montana, where I've hunted, I find, you know, the average hunter's walking around looking for the wide open ridges that look like the Wyoming range, you know, just there's not hardly a tree on them any more than a stunted spruce. And, you know, it's just wide open green. Well, that country's not like that, but I still find where the deer are that the timber is broken, scattered, maybe it's burnt. That's why burns can be so good. And it's allowing the sunlight to reach the ground and stimulate that growth. And plus heavy timber sucks all the water out of the ground. One of the first things that happens when a big burn goes through somewhere, guys will get out in the burn and they'll be like, wow, there's little springs popping up everywhere that weren't here before. Yeah, because all those big spruce and fir aren't sucking all the water up into the, it's not stored in the trees anymore. It's actually free to flow. And so, and then what does that do? That stimulates growth. And so that's why one reason mule deer populations can vary widely depending on the habitat, because, you know, as you get a burn or something that upsets the vegetation, like an avalanche, that can stimulate a lot of growth. And then the deer will move to that part. We're just getting ready to release a big article on Rockslide called Hunting Burns. It'll be on our homepage. Jim Carr wrote it. He's one of the scouts that works for my scouting business. He's spent more time in mule deer country than I have. He's been all over the place and he really focuses on burns. You should go read that article because he talks about a lot of this stuff about how this feed is follows these burns, and you know how old burns aren't as good, and you know that all that kind of stuff. And so deer are reacting to that stuff all the time, Chad, all the time. And so, and you know, beavers, that's why one thing might maybe it be a decline in mule deer, because we don't have a lot of beavers now. Beavers create a lot of mule deer habitat, you know, because they set the old growth back to new growth. And so it sounds like I'm getting off subject, but I'm not. I promise you, they're where the groceries are. They go where the feed is, and the feed is typically in the earlier season. It's going to be your green country. It's going to be your more semi-open country. If it's classic southern Idaho mule deer country, that's going to be wide open. Okay. But there's still a lot of mule deer that live up where Ryan lives that are not in wide open country, but they're still where the feed is. And even if I can't get to where I can glass those, that country, that's one thing we didn't cover a lot of here, is tracks are everything. And that, you know, tracks don't lie. And so a lot of times when I'm scouting in the summer, I'm just looking for their tracks. And Jim talks about that in that Hunting Burns article, is that sometimes his midday scouting is just looking for tracks, because the tracks are telling you where the deer are. Deer don't just randomly roam the country. They don't. They're where they're supposed to be. They're where their food is. They're where they can bed and everything. And so when I'm looking for places like that, Chad, it's typically green. It's typically semi-open. It's going to have places where they can bed. And they don't need to bed in a sea of fur that's, you know, 5,000 acres and they're right out in the very middle of it. No. Unless there's a lot of hunting pressure, they're not doing that. You know, they want to live easy like we do. You know, when we get in the truck to go to town to get groceries, we go to the closest grocery store. That's pretty much what they do too, unless there's a lot of hunting pressure. And so they're going to be bedding and you know, spending their days, because where they feed is a liability to them. They know that's where the predators are going to be. All right, you and me and the lions and the bears, you know, we know where to look for them. So that's why they're typically feeding at night and feeding in the fringes of light and everything. And then they leave those areas, and then they go and they go to the cover where they're safer. And then you get into the whole four stomach thing that a mule deer has. They have to chew their cud, you know, like a cow and all that stuff, you know. So they do that while they're in a resting state and they're bedded and, you know, stuff like that. And so what I'm getting at is that's why typically good mule deer country is broken up country. It's got a mixture of green feed. It's got the feed they need, and it's got pockets that they can bed in. If it's wide open mule deer country, that pocket may just be a little north facing coulee where they can get down under the lip of the coulee and be out of the hot sun all day. But then December rolls around, they'll be on the opposite side of the coulee laying in the sun. You see what I mean?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and so you see how there's not really any. The only formula is they have to eat and they have to bed. That's the main thing I'm trying to take in is and then at different times of years, you get late in the fall and everything's dead. There's nothing green. Well, what are they eating then? They're still eating the bushes that were green and the forbs that were green, and that there has to be low enough snow depth that they can actually reach them.
And when those bushes become brown, right, there's less water in them. Mm-hmm. Are they looking for more water at that point because they're getting less from vegetation?
I think it really depends on where they're at. I've seen mule deer live all winter where, as far as I can tell, every single water source is frozen solid.
Okay.
They're not drinking any water. They're getting it from the snow. And like, you know, I've got, I'm a horseman. So, you know, I'm looking out the window right now at my horses out there, and they're hardly drinking anything this time of year. You know, they're drinking 20% of what they drink in the summer. And so their water needs are lower, and I know they're getting a lot of it from the snow. Mm-hmm. Yet if you move into southern Arizona and everything, where some places there's no surface water, I've heard, I can't say I've read a study on it or anything, but you know, there's enough mule deer hunters down there that I kind of trust them when they all say the same thing, that they think some of those deer don't drink any surface water. It comes all from their plants. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if that was a question, you know, geared towards, do you, you know, are you worried about water? No, not at that time of year. I'm not even thinking about water.
Okay.
You know, that's kind of pretty much taken care of by them. And, you know, if they get it, whether they're getting it from the bushes or from the snow, I don't know, but obviously they're getting it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They got to get it somewhere. So, so a minute ago you mentioned we hadn't really touched on it too much. And I assume you're talking about scouting and glassing. So what are you doing in the off season? Are you scouting right now? Are you out looking, or what kind of things are you doing in the spring? What are you doing in the summer and early fall?
I'm working right now. I'm working my freaking butt off, you know, 10, 11 hours a day trying to get caught up on work. I work in the health club industry and I work for Rock Slide. Both of our peak seasons coincide right now. So I'm working, but every day I'm working is a day that I'm probably going to be able to work less in the fall. And so for me, just taking care of my life and my family and all of that stuff right now, that's preparing for mule deer hunting. I'm not a big shed hunter. I used to be, but you know, shed hunting just isn't what it used to be. There's just too many. It's one of the most unethical things going on in the woods right now. Now, I'm not saying if you shed hunt, you're unethical, but if you want to see some unethical behavior, go out here on these winter ranges and watch what has happened to shed hunting. You are going to see guys on quads, you know, crisscrossing the country, not on any roads, you know, shooting handguns, trying to get the deer to move. I mean, it has become kind of the worst kind of behavior. And not everybody's doing that. I'm not saying that at all. There's a lot of guys that are doing it right, but there's so many of us doing it, and it's such a stressful time for mule deer. Not everywhere. Some winter ranges, you know, you're not stressing deer at all. You know, they're living easy. There's no snow, and you know, but around here, dude, and it's been shown that, you know, humans stress those deer at the worst time of year for them. You know, they're just, because they have to move out of your way at a, you know, time when they wouldn't normally move much. You know, it's hard on them. And so I could never convince myself I wasn't part of that problem. And I know there's guys out there right now. They're like, oh, shut up, dude. It's, you know, it's shed hunting's fine. I argue with all these guys. I get it, you know. And but I just always felt like, hey, that hurt a deer that just ran away from me right here in this deep snow. They wouldn't be running if I wasn't out here shed hunting. And so my shed hunting turned more into kind of glassing the winter range in December and January before they lose their antlers, and trying to glass it from a distance so I don't bother them as much, and I can at least get an inventory of what the bucks look like in a particular unit. You know, how did they how'd they make it through the season? What are their antlers like? And then, yeah, if I find a big buck, I try to go out and pick up his antlers. And you know, whenever, or there's becoming a lot of shed seasons now, which I'm fully in support of, you know, so when the season opens, you know, I'll go out and try to pick up his antlers, you know. But what I'm getting at is I don't put a lot of time into looking at deer this time of year, because, you know, unless you're going to draw just a primo rifle tag that allows you to hunt on the winter range, there's not a lot of information to be gathered that's going to apply to hunting season. You know, I'm going to know what the bucks are because I looked at them in December and January when they still had their antlers. That's all I needed to know. And so I just don't spend a lot of time out right now. You know, I haven't been out for a couple of weeks, and when I did go out, I was just glassing from some main roads, you know, kind of looking at deer at a long distance. And then this time of year, I'm really working on getting my gear ready. You know, I'm out in my garage right now. I got tents hung up that need folded. I got a sleeping bag that needs sewn. I've been working on my archery equipment. You know, I'm just, you know, I haven't shot guns yet this year, but this time of year I start breaking them out. So it's all about gear for me and being ready. I hate when the season rolls around and I'm not ready. I hate it. You know, I mean, I've been years where, you know, the season opens tomorrow and I'm out in the shed trying to find my sleeping bag. I hate that stuff. And so this time of year is when I'm trying to make sure I'm, you know, all that stuff is ready so that when, you know, my first opportunity to go out comes, you know, I do a lot of horse stuff, so I got a lot of stuff to get ready for them, that, you know, I'm ready to go. The horses are ready, the horses are shooed, the panniers are put together. You know, there's some areas I scout with a motorbike. You know, I'll be changing the oil in my motorbike here in a couple weeks, you know, fixing my throttle cable, you know, that's the kind of stuff I'm thinking about this time of year. I'm not saying there's not any value in spending time in mule deer country at this time of year. I'm not saying that at all. And if you've got the time, and yeah, there's, you know, more information's better. But I just found for me, I'm better off to kind of focus on the domestic part of my life at this time. And, you know, I got three little kids. My twins just turned, you know, 13 today. And, you know, these years are flying by fast, you know, and I don't want to miss any of it, you know. And so, you know, I'm trying to spend a lot of time with my family, you know, because come fall, it's pretty sparse. You know, I don't hunt as much as what most people think, you know, probably between the middle of August and the 1st of December, you know, probably 40 days, you know, but that's 40 days I'm not home. That's, you know, 40 nights I'm gone. You know, it adds up, and so, you know, this time of year, I want to make sure I'm in the good graces of the wife. You know, I want her to have a good life, and my kids to know their daddy loves them, and I'm here for them. And yeah, there might be big spans of time when I'm gone, but you know, I want them to know that, you know, they're my life, my priority. And so I'm just not thinking a lot about mule deer this time of year beyond what I just said, you know, prepping the gear and stuff like that. And my jobs, the way my jobs work, the only reason I've kept these jobs over the years, because they work well with hunting season. They're super busy right now, but they're not very busy come fall. That's perfect. So it's worth me, you know, putting in the 10, 12 hours days sometimes right now, because I know I won't have to do that come you know, late summer and fall when I really do want to be in the hills.
Yeah. So that was my follow-on question, is when do you make that transition? And you're out and you really start scouting and you really start hammering the mountains and looking. When's that happen?
But late June.
Late June. Okay. So that gives you a couple of months moving into August to where then you got a pretty good idea where you're going to be hunting.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if it's high country, high elevation stuff, I don't typically do anything in that type of country till late summer, you know, August or so, because the deer just, if they're even up there by then, they're still not settled in, you know, like, you know, I think bucks arrive on some of that country in June and July. Definitely they do. I've seen them, but they can be still really mobile. You don't know exactly where they're going to be. So the early stuff is typically, you know, low elevation foothill type country that I'm looking at, you know, and that's the stuff that's kind of early in the summer.
Okay.
I like to spread it out a little bit too, because, you know, once that time of year comes, you know, I'm in the hills 3-4 days a week, and you get tired. I get tired. You know, you get burnt out when you're in mule deer country from the end of June to the 1st of December. It wears on you, and so you got to have, you know, some periods of downtime and rest and all that stuff. And I didn't used to think that. I used to think, no, just go hard, you know, the harder the better. No, man, you get worn out. You start hunting ineffectively. You don't even want to be there. And that sounds so foreign this time of year, because, you know, we're thinking, oh man, I'd love to be able to go hunting today. I'd love to be up in my deer country. But no, I want to be in the deer country when I'm mentally sharp and ready to be there. And if I'm so flipping burned out because I haven't had any rest, I've tried to hunt that way. I'm just not effective.
I think there's a big difference between 25 and 50 years old too that might play a factor there.
Yeah, and I kill a hell of a lot more big bucks at 50 years old than I did at 25.
Yeah, good. So as we kind of wind this thing down, I wanted to make a few references. And one, we already talked about rock slide and how much information you could find over there, articles. And you mentioned this, Jim Carr?
Jim Carr, yeah, he lives in Coeur d'Alene too. He's up there where you're at, Ryan.
Oh, nice. I'll have to catch him one of these days.
Yeah, he's publishing a bunch of articles on rock slide right now. There's a Kuyu Talus article he just did a review on the other day. This dude punishes his gear, so we love it when he starts testing his gear. And he works in the oil fields too, so he travels all over the West, and that's why he's worked for my scouting service for years, because, you know, he's just covers so much country, and, you know, he's just such a good scout. So yeah, definitely you can read his articles. Maybe you could look him up there. He's a good guy. He'll have that Hunting the Burns article. He's got a scouting article coming out, and he's a wealth of information. He really is.
Any other?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ryan.
Oh no, I was going to say, I'll have to check it out. I'm hoping to upgrade or get a couple of new pieces of gear this year. And I've been doing a little bit of research on rock slide, trying to decide which way to go with some of it. But I'll have to check out his articles.
Yeah. Check out his articles. And then also, if you go to the Avery Adventures podcast, they interviewed him like last month. You'll see it on there. And he kind of talks about scouting a lot in there. Listen to it. It'll help you. Even though he scouts a lot for elk, he's a heck of a mule deer hunter too. They're just good stuff in there. And, you know, this is kind of the first year the world is discovering Jim Carr. He's worked for me for 10 years. And, you know, I've only ever had a couple of guys I would hire to scout in our business. And he was one of them. And, you know, he's just a good resource. So check that podcast out too.
Okay, thanks.
Any other places you want to tell people or you want to point people towards for reference or resources?
My book, I released it in 2015. It's called Hunting Big Mule Deer, How to Take the Best Buck of Your Life. I would encourage anybody to read that, even if you're not totally into big mule deer, because what I've kind of learned is you can learn to hunt the big ones, the easy ones. The smaller ones are easier. I shouldn't say easy. They're never easy, but they're easier. And, just a lot of stuff we talked about today is in that book and everything. You can get it on Amazon. Is the fastest way to get it. If you want a signed copy, it's in the Rock Slide store. Just look on our forums. There's a link at the top that says store, and it's in there. And those come directly from me. I can sign those and, put messages in them, whatever you want. A lot of guys will buy them for their buddies on their birthday and have me put some smart aleck remark in them. It's kind of funny. There's that. And then, I'm on all the social media. I'm not a big poster, but I'm there if you want to find it on Instagram and Facebook, just Robbie Denning under my name. And Rock Slide's really the best. That's where I spend most of my time. You can PM me from there. You'll see I'm active on the forums. I post every day. The blog that's on Rock Slide, that's me. That's all my articles. So if you go to the blog, that will be all the articles that I've personally written.
Okay. Tons of stuff out there. All right, Robbie. Well, I think we just nailed down all your contact information too. So we got Instagram, Facebook. I will link in to the show description a link to your book on Amazon, and then I'll do the Rock Slide store. And what's your scouting service?
It's called We Scout for You.
Is there a website?
Yeah, wescoutforyou.com.
Okay.
Yeah, we've had that for about 20 years, and we're pretty small. We only take about 15 packages a year. Those are kind of spread out through the West, and I'm booked solid already. Jim is probably going to be full here in the next month or two. So, but we just make it so guys can get really familiar with their area fast. Save them 2 or 3 days of screwing around trying to figure out where to camp, where to hunt, what hillsides to look at, stuff like that. So. Been doing that for a long time, but yeah, guys can check that out too.
And what's the radius on that? Like, is it only Idaho, or are you encompassing?
It varies just a little bit. Some of it depends on where we're at. So like right now, Jim is working in Western Wyoming. And so he'll be taking some packages there most likely. And then he's done a ton of stuff in Montana. And so he'll take some packages up there. So this year, probably mostly Idaho, a little bit of Western Wyoming. He's probably got some Montana stuff available. And some of it depends on a little bit, just getting the permits. I'm working with BLM right now, and on some areas, just if the permits aren't available, we can't go there, and stuff like that. So just get a hold of him. Just email me from the website. I'll get you in touch with him. He can tell you what he's got.
Okay. And is that mule deer only, or elk and
no, it's everything? In fact, I think he does a lot more elk than he does mule deer.
Okay, got it. Perfect.
And the few I can take per year, I've been doing it for 20 years, so I've got people I can just reach out to each year that have hired me over the years. A trusted customer is great, and so the ones I do, if I do any, it'll be mule deer.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. And last thing is, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you could give one piece of advice to somebody that wants to start mule deer hunting, what's that one piece of advice?
Move slower. We move too fast. We think when we're moving slow, we're moving slow. No. We're completely foreign to the forest. There's nothing in the forest that walks like us, smells like us, makes noise like us. And the only way to overcome mule deer senses in a lot of cases is just moving slower. And it doesn't mean you move slow everywhere you go, but when you're in mule deer country and there are deer within range, most of the ones that have got away from me, almost all of them, is because I was moving too fast.
Yeah, I was trying to cover a bunch of ground my very last mule deer hunt that I was on this year, and I was trying to find tracks, and the only tracks I found were deer running away from me.
Exactly. You're exactly right. Now I don't want to say that you never want to cover a bunch of ground. You do. Like when you're looking for deer and trying to narrow down country, you got to do that. But when you start seeing those tracks on the ground that are fresh, it's time to slow down.
Okay, guys. Well, I appreciate it. Real quick, Ryan, what's your Instagram and Facebook and all that, in case people want to throw you a piece of advice or reach out and ask questions about Idaho?
I'm on Facebook. It's Ryan Johnson. Johnson is spelt with an E. That's kind of interesting. And on Instagram, I use PN Wanders, like PNW Anders, I guess, if you want to, but PN Wanders.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'll put all that information in the show notes, and there'll be a ton of links in these show notes, because there's a lot of good information. So first off, Robbie, thank you very much for coming on. Great show. I think it worked out really, really good. And Ryan, thank you for coming on and putting together those questions and building a really good interview. I think that went well.
Yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity. And Robbie, it was great talking with you and getting some great information. Really appreciate it.
You bet, man. Same back to you guys. And it was a fun show. And I've never really done one like this before. And hope I didn't blab on too much.
No, it was awesome. I was really, really, it was great.
Yeah.
I thought so too.
I usually try to keep them to an hour, but I wasn't going to stop this one. There's too much good information. If it's a really good one, you know, and it's going on good, I'm not going to slow it down. So anyway, thanks guys. I'm sure you guys have a busy day to get to, and I appreciate you taking time this morning. All right. So I definitely want to say thank you to Robbie for coming on. And I want to say thank you to Ryan, too. Ryan did a great job. We didn't really do any kind of rehearsal or anything. He just jumped on here and was ready to go and ready to talk about mule deer hunting. So I really appreciate, first off, I appreciate his input in the beginning about asking all those questions and really triggering that idea for a mule deer show. And then I really appreciate Robbie accepting the invitation and coming on and being willing to share that information with us. So thank you to both of you guys. All of their contact information is listed in the show notes, along with all of Robbie's contact information and his book and where to buy it. We Scout for You, Rock Slide. I linked everything into the show notes. So if you're looking for Robbie, or you're looking for Ryan, or you're looking for me, or if you want to save 20% on University of Elk Hunting, I've got links to all of that stuff in the show description. And lastly, I want to say, leave a review. So if you liked the idea of how we did this, where I brought on a guest host, leave a review. I've got a few ideas of some other shows I was thinking about doing it this way. Leave a review. Let me know if you liked it or not. And if you didn't, okay, give me some ideas. Jump in the Backcountry Rookies Nation and give me some ideas on how to fix it or how to do it better. And next week, I have Jesse Greger coming on. Jesse is from Next Mile Meals, which is sort of a keto-focused backcountry meal planner, right? So they're just dehydrated meals that you can buy, and they're designed around keto, so they're low carb, high calorie, high protein type meals, and they're fantastic. I know a lot of times we say that you got to bump up your carbs and you got to hammer the carbs when you're out there in the backcountry. Well, Jesse gives you that opportunity or that option to do that. So you can get one of her low-carb meals. For example, they have a roast beef one, and you can get some bagel thins and throw the roast beef on the bagel thins, and that increases your carbs. You can get the meatball marinara and add some pasta to it. There's so many different options. But what the great thing is, if you're out on a bear hunt or something, and you're just sitting around, and all you're doing is glassing all day, and you don't want to be slamming carbs down your throat, eat a low-carb meal. If you're out really covering mileage and you're doing 10 miles a day and you need to bump those carbs up, you have that opportunity too. So they're really versatile, and that's what I like about them. And they taste real good. So that's another thing. Anyway, next week coming up, Jesse Greger, Next Mile Meals. Thanks again to Robbie. Thanks again to Ryan. Thanks again to everybody for listening. I really appreciate it. Out of here.